So, Hisho, you've written the show notes for this episode, which is very nice. Of course, you're hosting it. And like we always do, you've color-coded like which bit you're going to say, which bit I'm going to say. So yours are in green and mine are in purple. And I think I started this trend way back, except you were in purple and I was in green. And the reason for this is that when I edit the episodes on Adobe Audition, I always color my tracks green and your tracks purple. So I have no idea when it switched around, but it's a bit strange.
Well, I just... I don't know. I mean, I like green and I like purple. They're my two favorite colors. So I just... I think there was an episode where I used brown and orange or something like that. So I don't think you can really complain.
I'm sure I would have promptly changed that.
I don't think you can really complain about the purple and green.
You know, actually, on the topic of purple and green, when I was at BMIS, year 7 design with Mr. What was his name? Raphael something?
Something
like Ferrero.
That. Yeah, yeah,
it was Mr.
Yeah,
Ferrero.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we were doing this design thing. We were using like this publishing software and we were supposed to use like complementary colors. And so I was like, purple and green. I'm making this beautiful document, 4 pages long.
I love purple and green. I have to say, I don't like purple and green together. Like the palette does not, they're not complementary of each other. I mean, okay, if you get like a lavender purple and a foliage green, if you get two like very mild greens and purples, it can work. But when you have like that super abrupt green and that like poppy purple and then you like throw them together, they just clash and it looks kind of evil, like something out of like a, yeah.
Because as some artists listening may have been screaming at their phones saying, is that actually purple is complementary to yellow, not green. So I was wrong all along.
All
anyway,
right.
Should we get started?
Yeah.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Fighting Failure.
This episode is applicable to everyone, everywhere, anytime, anyhow. So we want this to reach as many people as possible. If you like this episode, please share this episode with others and let Spotify, YouTube, or iTunes know that you enjoyed it. Today's episode is probably the one that I've looked forward to the most because today we're covering sustainable architecture and urban design. From Generation, this is Fighting Failure. I'm Hisham Kanin, your host for this episode.
I'm your co-host and producer, Oscar Archibald. This is episode 30.
First, for those of us who might not know what sustainable architecture is, let's give a quick definition.
Sustainable development is a general term that refers to architecture and an architectural vision of human suburbia that limits its impact on the environment and may even be integrated with the environment.
So let's start with just tackling what is wrong with how we build buildings today so that we can get into the more fun aspect of urban architecture. So firstly, the materials. So concrete is one of the most fundamental materials that we use today. And according to an article by The Guardian, in 1 year, enough concrete is produced globally to cover the entire United Kingdom. And concrete is second only to water in the list of our most used resources. And yet we think so little of it. I mean, over the past couple of months at school, we've put up a whole new concrete patio. I mean, we have 3 concrete patios in our PE area now. And they're actually completely flawed because they go right over these tree roots. So whenever those trees come down, they're going to be torn up and then they'll have to be rebuilt. And it's just, concrete is just everywhere. I mean, if you look outside, there's a great chance that you'll see concrete in your wall, on your driveway. I mean, even in your house, there's a good chance that there's concrete in the foundation. So I mean, it's just everywhere.
I'm looking outside now.
Yeah.
And I can tell you, in fact, in the UK, the footpaths are made of tarmac, but the curb is like all these slabs of concrete just like going all the way along. Looking around, I think that's about it in terms of what I can see in front of me. But then again, like, I'm just looking onto this greenery, which is quite nice, rather than an urban hellscape. So your mileage may vary. So in modern history, concrete is one of the most foundational building blocks. We use it for everything from buildings to walls to foundations. In fact, almost all man-made structures.
And quite literally one of the most foundational building blocks, because it is literally the foundational building block for almost all of our buildings and all of our infrastructure today.
Aren't we so punny? The use of concrete to build structures could date back centuries. In ancient Rome, a form of concrete was used to build the Colosseum, which is still standing today. If you've been to Rome, you can attest to that. But one of the moments that defined the importance of concrete in our lives was the use of concrete after the Second World War to rebuild entire cities. It was used primarily as it was easy to manipulate and cheap to buy.
So not only does concrete degrade from the natural beauty, as I'm sure most of us can agree, but its accessibility promotes urban expansion and encroachment on natural habitats. I mean, I can go literally to the corner store here and buy a bag of cement, which means I can build absolutely anything, any, you know, cement structure in my garden. I could fix up my driveway. I mean, it's so easy just to get concrete as an individual and to use it in on your property and to use it just in your lives. And it's easy for, of course, then for companies and for mass producers of products to use concrete. And so it really promotes this expansion because concrete is just so accessible. You can just, you know, you can go get some concrete and build what you need. So it's cheap too. It's really affordable. Like a lot of the houses here in Malawi are just concrete with like tin slats on the for the roofs. I mean, it just goes to show how easy concrete is to use and how easy it is to build up with concrete.
Yeah, and I think at this point it is worth us clarifying what's different between concrete and cement. So concrete on the one hand, well, no, cement on the one hand is this sort of powder that is made in this industrial process that releases a lot of carbon dioxide it will come onto. And then that's the sort of powder that you buy. And then in order to make concrete, you mix the, sort of a water mixture of cement. You mix this solution of cement with gravel to like harden it up and sand. And that what gives it sort of that bulk. And with cement's binding power, concrete sort of gives that bulk and gives you that solid structure once it sets. And I think the setting is an exothermic reaction. I'm not sure.
You just did exothermic and endothermic in chemistry?
Oh yeah, ages ago.
Yeah, we did that too.
I'm pretty sure it releases heat, doesn't it?
Right? I'm not sure about that specific application, but I literally just have my chemistry exam and it was one of the earlier topics that we did, so I've literally just been revising exothermic, endothermic, enthalpy, all this. Yeah.
Concrete has also been proven to degrade soil quality, water cleanliness, and many other crucial parts of surrounding ecosystems. Of course, this affects wild animals, but if you don't care about wild animals, I mean, I don't know why you wouldn't, but problems with water cleanliness and soil quality will come back to haunt us too, because if we are polluting those lovely rivers and streams that go past our cities, and then we're also drawing from those rivers and streams in order to drink, or trying to use this polluted soil to grow, we're going to be facing some issues in our own human society as well.
So sort of one of our biggest points here is the production of cement is very carbon intensive. And according to Our World in Data, more than 3% of global greenhouse gas emissions come from the production of cement, about on par with all emissions from global waste.
So if we think about that, my sister is always trying to tell me, food waste, if food waste were a country, it would be the third biggest polluter. And yes, that's true. Food waste is a huge problem. But all waste combined is 3% of global emissions. And all cement production combined is 3% of global emissions. In fact, it's a bit more than 3% because that's just counting the carbon dioxide emissions from the chemical conversion. There's also the energy required to drive this process and all the processes surrounding the production of cement.
I mean, yeah, and global waste includes everything from food waste to clothing, fast fashion and clothing waste to plastic production and that waste. So, and the decomposition of, you know, different things that we throw out. And so this is just, I mean, if you think about like the magnitude of that, you think, I mean, just because of how amplified sort of waste has been in sort of the environmental society, it seems like such a daunting problem. But in fact, we have cement, which is the next door neighbor to waste, and we're not doing anything to tackle that. I mean, my school, in Malawi has this entire sort of like green initiative, and with the new director, and it, everything is great, and we're doing, I'm involved in a ton of activities that are doing, you know, different projects to reduce the impact of the school and to re-green different parts of the school. But in fact, at the same time, we're just throwing concrete everywhere. I mean, even in one of the gardens that was sort of reestablished this year, they've put concrete slabs for the walkway. And I mean, it's hard to create a walkway. I'll give that to them. And I mean, of course, they're trying to cut budget, but just the fact that we use concrete so liberally and we think about everything else so much just shows how swept under the rug concrete really is. Even the foundations, we had a couple of years ago, we had a jungle gym put up in the primary, which was actually quite annoyingly the year after I moved out of primary, so I was no longer able to use it. Yeah, Oscar was there when that happened, which we were both disappointed about. But anyway, it was the whole foundation of that. Like I said, you know, concrete is just, it's foundational, both, you know, like literally, as well as sort of generally. And so it was literally the foundation of the entire jungle gym that had been put up. And it's still there. They've now taken down the jungle gym because it got eaten by termites. And it's like, what do they do about the concrete? They've just dug it up and now there's chunks of concrete just laying around. And it's also just like so hard. Like, how do you get rid of concrete as well? And it's just such a big pollutant once it's, you know, in the environment. It's so hard to get rid of and dispose of.
When we lived in Malawi, we built a swing set in our garden and we had this guy come and he poured concrete and he told us, well, you need to make sure you use anti-termite oil or whatever because the termites are going to come and eat it. And then the termites come and eat it and it fell apart. So anyway, back on topic. The reason why 3% of global emissions come from the production of cement is because carbon dioxide is a chemical byproduct of the chemical conversion of chalk to lime. So calcium carbonate, CaCO3, for the chemists among us, is then converted to CaO, calcium oxide, or lime. And that releases, obviously, you've got two spare oxygens, they bond with the carbon, whatever, and that will produce carbon dioxide. So it's not just like polluting because you're burning something to heat it up. It is literally for every, like a bit of, every molecule of lime. It's not really a molecule because it's, I think it's ionically bonded. I'm not entirely sure, but for every unit of lime, we could say, you're producing a unit of carbon dioxide or a molecule of carbon dioxide. So fact check me on my chemistry, but you can't fact check me on the magnitude of this pollution. Yes.
And so then, yeah, moving away from concrete now. One of the foundational structures of the bulk of our buildings is steel, and the global production of which makes up about 7.8% of greenhouse gas emissions.
Which is bigger than that of cement, but I think this is iron and steel globally, and that's the energy usage for it. So if you look at the pie chart of global emissions, you've got, so the in the pie chart, which is energy, which just makes about 78% of global emissions from energy. And then there's like 24% globally is emissions from industry, and then 7.8% globally is like energy used to make steel. And that, I think that's because coke is the name of the stuff that you use to make steel. Try to remember the metals topic. And you heat it up and they're heating up in a kiln and the coke, and that makes a lot of emissions. I'll need to check my chemistry notes for that. But that is why steel is also extremely carbon intensive to make. Okay, so I've just opened this book by Bill Gates, which is How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. I've gone to the chapter on how we make things. So I want to read a few excerpts. So we like steel because it's both strong and easy to shape when it's hot. To make steel, you need pure iron and carbon. On its own, iron isn't very strong, but add just the right amount of carbon, less than 1%, depending on the kind of steel you want, and the carbon atoms nestle themselves in between the iron atoms, giving the resulting steel its important properties. Carbon and iron aren't hard to find. You can get carbon from coal. And iron is a common element in the Earth's crust. But pure iron is quite rare. When you dig up the metal, it's almost always combined with oxygen and other elements, a mixture known as iron ore. To make steel, you need to separate the oxygen from the iron and add a tiny bit of carbon. You accomplish both at the same time by melting iron ore at very high temperatures, 1,700 degrees Celsius, in the presence of oxygen and a type of coal called coke. At those temperatures, the iron ore releases its oxygen and the coke releases its carbon. A bit of the carbon bonds with the iron, forming the steel we want, and the rest of the carbon grabs the oxygen, forming a byproduct we don't want, carbon dioxide. Quite a bit of carbon dioxide, in fact. Making 1 ton of steel produces 1.8 tons of carbon dioxide. So there you go. That is a better explanation of how steel is almost always made. This is the cheapest way. This is why it's so commonly used.
And so our next, these are some quicker points than concrete now. Our next point is fake wood and plastic. And this has sort of become very widely used nowadays. I mean, fake wood is everywhere because it's so much more durable, of course, because it's plastic than real wood. I mean, real wood, like me and Oscar were saying, can get eaten by termites. It'll biodegrade over years. Woodpeckers can take it away. Like, there's different birds that can, you know, sort of eat away at it, and it's just so much harder to maintain. So of course, a lot of people resort to this sort of fake wood and plastic for sort of the exterior of a lot of buildings, but also for the interior of a lot of buildings. And of course, you know, this is bad for obvious reasons, because once that building is taken down, where does that plastic go, right? And of course, then you're just supporting sort of the widespread use of plastic, and it's a very thick plastic, and it can shed and it can create microplastics, so there's, you know, obvious problems there. And then the last point here is wood, and wood is not the biggest of problems here, but, you know, if sourced unsustainably, so if you're not, you know, consciously checking where you get your wood from, if it's not from a plantation or from a tree farm, then there's a chance that this wood could be coming from some genuine forest, which is then obviously not good, because of course you cut down the tree and it, you know, as it biodegrades, it releases all the CO2 that it's ever absorbed, and then you're taking away at the trees that have the potential to absorb CO2, and so then, you know, there's those very basic problems that, you know, I won't go into too much depth with. I forgot to add, as my sort of final point here about the materials, is I think bitumen, is it called? It's this...
Bitumen, asphalt, yeah.
Yeah, and it's... I don't know if, you know, you guys are familiar with, you know, how this is sort of produced, but it's, you have the sort of like, it's a hydrocarbon. It's like it's pretty much petroleum. It's the simplest way that I can put it.
So yeah, so it's not petroleum. It's a byproduct. It's not a byproduct either. It is one of the fractions of crude oil. So petroleum is a fraction of crude oil and bitumen is a fraction of crude oil.
But it has the same impact, is my point. It's like, you know, it's like that the tarmac with, you know, which we put over the road is just as bad as the gas which we're burning in our cars. I mean, it's also just one of those things that we just don't think about. Well, you're not burning it continuously, but the production is really bad, and the excess, I mean, there's use literally everywhere. Everywhere you have urban expansion, there's this necessity, modern necessity to have road network expansion, because, as we'll kind of get to it, this leads perfectly into our next point, is urban sprawl.
This extract is from episode 25.
As kind of urban sprawling occurs, there's this need to accommodate for people need easily accessible food sources, people need to easily be able to go somewhere to get their hair cut, and then there's all these leisure things, such as like getting your nails, places to get your nails done, places to buy clothes, etc. And so that needs to be easily accessible again. So then there's this encouragement for expansion in terms of like malls and grocery stores and other smaller stores. And a lot of these are built with and as kind of inaccessible by anything other than a car. As the urban sprawl occurs, so as these new developments are built outwards from that urban area, these new developments are often encroaching on natural habitats and kind of forcing wildlife away. Urban sprawling is, you know, as the name suggests, so we're kind of moving outwards, we're kind of, we're conquering outwards, we're encroaching on the environment sort of in an outwards movement, so expanding in kind of like, tends to be like circular zones around the city,
And that's as a result of kind of these like two-story houses that house one family. Then, you know, as the number of families increase, you know, A, because there's this, you know, because urban areas are more practical because of the way that they've been made out to be. But B, because of because of already existing urban sprawling, kind of accommodating for an increase in population, and then resulting in a need for more housing as kind of those children come of age and then have their own families. And so there's this increase, and it's all outwards because there's a need for more houses, which means a need for more space because you need backyards, maybe a pool, that two-story house. It needs to be big enough to accommodate for that large family, that those two garages.
Thirdly, the need to import products from far beyond the city's boundaries creates carbon emissions and puts strain on ecosystems outside of the urban area. Hey everyone, so while the music's playing, I just thought I'd say a few things. First of all, we have a Patreon page. Link's in the description. It starts at $1 a month and that'll help us reinvest into making this podcast. It takes hours and hours to make every podcast, and if you could help us, that'd be great. Secondly, if you're enjoying this, and only if you're enjoying it, an Apple Podcast 5-star review would mean the world to us, because that is really, Apple is, you know, the main podcast platform. That's really what's going to help spread this podcast far and wide for everyone who wants or needs to hear this message. We also publish episodes on YouTube if that's more convenient. And if you want to follow us for updates, that's all going to be on Instagram as well. Back to the show.
Hi, I'm Sandhya Stapleton. I co-founded this podcast and co-hosted in season one. I've recently given a TED Talk about climate change. If you want to listen to that, it'll be in the first link in the show notes. Miss you all, enjoy the episode, and please give us a good review on Apple Podcasts.
So, now we're going to move on to the problems.
Solutions.
What is sustainable architecture, and how can we use it to make our cities better places? Sustainable architecture is already being implemented in many places around the world. One example is Singapore's 150 feet tall, that's around 50 meters for those of us using the correct system, biometric trees. These artificial trees generate solar power while aiding in water retention and cooling nearby houses and buildings. You may also have seen images of the theoretical vertical forest buildings proposed, and in some cases built, by China, Singapore, and other nations. But luckily, sustainable development doesn't necessarily mean these huge, brand new buildings that house trees as well as humans. It could just be small-scale regreening projects that you suggest your local council, school, or workplace.
Yeah, just like Oscar said, sustainable development does not need to be these huge projects. I mean, just in my school community, I've been involved in a couple of projects this year, and my favorite project has been there's this old garden sort of towards the back of the school around where the year 11 bubble group was, which is my sort of grade. And so we were in that area with the garden just sort of nearby. And so when my bio teacher was putting out these extracurricular programs, she made this program that was sort of that had this objective to sort of work on and reestablish the garden, because the garden had been completely run down by a total lack of attention and the dry season and just, you know, an accumulation of leaves that had not been sort of cleaned out and that could be, you know, hazardous, fire hazards, you know, whatever. And so me and a couple of my friends signed up and we started working on it. And I mean, we, you know, as a group, we raked the leaves, we cleaned the trash out of the garden, we dug these sort of trenches that aid in water retention, we took out any trees that were hazardous or invasive, we sort of put in some recycled, or let's say upcycled benches that we helped sort of establish in the garden so that people could commune there. And we Oscar, I don't know if you remember, but in this garden that I'm referring to, you know, like the old design classrooms, if you walk up towards the art room from the design classrooms, you know, you used to pass like the smoking lounge, like where the teachers used to smoke. Okay. Anyway, there was this like little wooden thing where teachers used to like hide in and like crouch in a corner and smoke their cigarettes and stuff. And this building was just there with, I mean, it's not a building, it's like a wooden shack. There's not even a roof. But it's just in the back of the garden. And there was an already established walkway. So we are turning the back into sort of a communal area. And we're using the vines that were climbing up the sides, the inside and the outside, to provide a sort of green roofing. It's not necessarily roofing to protect you from the rain, but it's just roofing to kind of provide a shade and this sort of like microclimate. And so there's like, there's all these little projects that you can get involved in with your school. Talk to a teacher to get, you know, to get it started, or maybe a teacher offers something and you can get involved through that, like what happened in this specific case, or you could contact, you know, your local government. Like there's so many things that you can do just to get involved in regreening and environmental projects just in your local community to make your suburbia a greener place.
Yeah, so, or if you live in more urban environment, your urbia as well, I don't know if that's a word. I mean, recently in our most recent eco group meeting, we were talking about how we could introduce bug hotels and bug hotels and bird houses to, there's also a wildflower meadow that's been recently planted, trying to get the school area just a bit more green, because it just makes it more pleasant and it's also good for the environment.
So the next point is sort of in this vein,
or should I say, phloem.
Urban agriculture is also becoming far more popular worldwide and is a huge step forward in terms of sustainable food production. And so if you've listened to last year's season one, we did some stuff on agriculture, but we never touched on urban agriculture, which is why I'm just throwing it in here. And so as you can sort of expect, you know, as the name sort of suggests, urban agriculture is just agriculture in your urbia. I don't know if that's actually a thing in your suburban area. And so sort of the idea with urban agriculture, which can be sort of balcony or porch, sort of like gardens, you can have like a tomato pot so that you don't need to go to the store to buy tomatoes. Like there's just these little things that you can do. Or perhaps you have a slightly bigger house on sort of that outer edge of the city and you have a garden, and you could establish sort of like a bed for a proper, like a vegetable garden, and establish that, and so you could grow. I mean, lettuce is so easy to grow. It's so hard to kill lettuce. and basil, tomatoes. Like, we have a garden just in our garden here. I mean, a vegetable garden. We do have a big yard because we're, I mean, in Malawi. But, I mean, even in an urban area, if you have any sort of garden, you can invest in a raised bed if you can't create a sort of direct vegetable garden, and then just invest in getting some seeds and plant them and try your best not to kill them, and you might have a completely sustainable, ready-to-access food source that sort of just reduces the necessity to go to the store and purchase, you know, potentially imported GMO, pesticide and fertilizer-intensive produce. And so this is just a big step forward in a very small way. So this is just another thing that you could do that would be very helpful and very impactful in a very small scale.
Yeah. What's really cool about urban agriculture and vertical farming is that you don't need soil. So all of the problems that come with soil are just like completely gone. You just like use this like hydroponic water system or something like that. And it's...
We have hydroponics in Malawi now. There's this place doing hydroponic agriculture, and they're actually, not that this is great, like, not that, you know, I'm supporting export. They do still supply locally, but they just became so good at this sort of hydroponic process that they're now exporting to like Saudi Arabia and like different parts of the Middle East, and it's just, it's crazy. I mean, it is a great business, but it's not that I support. Of course, what we're trying to say here is don't, you know, try and limit the demand for imported goods by, you know, reducing your purchasing of imported goods to reduce the sort of supply chain, which is a great episode. Go back and listen to that if you haven't already.
Yeah. So the next thing that we can do, and this is much more of like not something you can necessarily do yourself, but something that governments need to work on and city councils, and that's something you can push for politically, but it's not something we can necessarily do on our own. That's beside the point anyway. The solution is reintroduction of insects, especially wild bees, to help pollinate and populate green spaces. And can I make this clear? Not honeybees. This is not like making honey, because that's not good for the environment. We're talking about wild bee species. And so that's a variety of different bee species rather than just the one honeybee species. Wild bees, as well as other insects, and birds and all these sort of animals that we can reintroduce into these green spaces to make them a lot more natural, provide home for these animals, and make the green spaces better for the environment too.
And you can make insect sort of, I don't know what it's called, like an insect box. I've seen them before. I mean, it's definitely doable. I don't know what it's called though. They're sort of like bird houses and bird feeders, but for insects. But they're super cool. I mean, there's just ways that you can, I mean, on the small scale, integrate animals and it just, you know, insects into your urban habitat. And for obvious reasons, that's, you know, much more environmentally beneficial, because then you're not just eliminating them by excluding them entirely from the growing suburbia. And we'll talk more about this, you know, in a later point on the large scale. The next point is just retrofitting buildings to make them more energy efficient. An example of this is just using LED light bulbs, which is a very simple, again, solution, which is what we're looking at right now. We've covered this in a previous episode, I believe, right?
Yeah, so you definitely want to be replacing incandescent bulbs and all that. But if you've got fluorescent tubes, you may actually not want to replace those. Here's an extract from episode 23.
In terms of mentioning fluorescent tubes, that's another example of where LEDs can be made to fit in a form factor for an old-fashioned fitting. So you can now get these so-called retrofit fluorescent tubes, and all they are is LEDs crammed into a long tube-shaped enclosure, which you can then put in your ceiling in place of a fluorescent tube. Now, I personally don't think that's a very good route.
Because I know you personally have reasons that you don't necessarily like LEDs.
In the home, and compared with incandescent lamps, which is, it, broadly speaking, in domestic contexts, people are moving from incandescent lamps to LEDs. The difference in efficiency is very pronounced. So for the same light output, in terms of the same brightness, you could be going from 100 watt incandescent bulb to, let's say, a 12 watt LED bulb. So that's nearly 10 times more efficient. And so that's a massive improvement in efficiency. And in terms of fluorescent tubes and sodium lamps also for that matter, the difference in efficiency between fluorescent tubes and LEDs, or sodium lamps and LEDs, is much less pronounced than it would be going from incandescent lamps to LEDs. So the financial saving and environmental saving is a lot lower.
Another solution is installing solar panels on rooftops. And when we were in the Outer Hebrides, we also saw that a lot of people had wind turbines in their back gardens. If you were in the middle of a city, that may not be the best idea. But if you're somewhere that's very windy, then you may want to.
Well, there's this sort of image in sort of urban architecture that's sort of coming up, is the idea of having wind turbines on top of buildings, which is not, you know, it's not widely used and it's not widely applied, but it is definitely a possibility, you know, going forward. I mean, wind turbines, I recently did a project on wind energy, and I mean, they're crazy expensive to install. But of course, you know, over time that price will be driven down, and then eventually when they're more, you know, affordable, there is definitely the option to install them for small-scale use.
You know, you're right. Yeah, I don't see many people getting council permission to build huge wind turbines on top of their buildings. I think wind is something that's best done offshore or in rural areas, but solar panels are absolutely something that we should, can and should be doing, because no, it's not, unlike wind turbines potentially, it's not like unsightly if someone's got solar panels on their roof. It's just useful. There are some grid challenges with accommodating for that sort of power coming from the bottom up rather than the top down, but listen to 18 for that, I guess. This is good stuff.
Make sure that you have good installation. Sorry, what were you going to say?
Yeah, this is a good one. Good insulation is so, so important, because it basically, it means that you don't have to cool your house in summer and you don't have to heat it in winter, or at least to a lesser degree. And this is something that is so crucial, especially in lots of the old houses we have in Britain. If it's a new built house, it should absolutely have top-notch insulation. But also it's worth considering, especially like a loft insulation is something that can be retrofitted pretty easily. And if you do that, it'll save you tons on your heating bills, as well as being really good for the environment.
I think I almost just said, when I was just about to say this point, I almost said good installation. I have no idea what was going through my mind. I was reading installation and seeing installation, and at the same time hearing Oscar, and I was like, oh, sorry, I'm interjecting, and then just the wrong word came out entirely. So next, to reduce water usage in your household, investing in low-flow taps and shower heads, and of course avoiding baths, is just a small thing you can do that can have a large impact on actually water consumption within urban areas. And I recommend that you look into the low-flow shower head that you're purchasing, because I have used a low-flow shower head before that was really quite horrible. Like, you could not clean yourself with it. It was just like this super thin. It wasn't like, there's some which it's like misty, but it still cleans you. But this one is just this super thin mist that just wafted down onto you, and it's like, can't clean the soap off. It is a great solution, but look into it to make sure that you're actually going to be able to use it efficiently.
So the last thing, and I'm quite passionate about this, is install a heat pump in your whole house. Instead of having a gas boiler or an electric boiler, I know electric boilers, if you have clean energy, are supposedly good, but they're really bad, just electrical resistance boilers. So the thing is that you can replace your gas boiler or electric resistance boiler with a heat pump, whether that's ground source, water source, or air source. And you will need to, Wolfie's being a bit noisy. You will need to probably, if you're in the UK at least, reinstall all your radiators with wider ones, because it's less hot, so you need bigger surface area. That's a bit difficult and a bit expensive. And this is something that we need governments to incentivize and to subsidize, because it's way too expensive. You can't expect average people to pay like thousands and thousands of pounds for a greener heating solution that might not even be as effective. But something else you can do, and I would really recommend, and I'm trying to get my family to do this, is to install basically an air conditioner, but it's called a split cycle air conditioner, and they can basically heat your room as well as cooling it. So if there's one room that you find that you heat the most, whether that's the master bedroom or the living room or the kitchen, whichever, find one room that you heat the most, put a split cycle air conditioner in there. This doesn't require to change your whole central heating system. It's just got an outside unit and an inside unit, just like a normal air conditioner does. And then use that to heat your room in the room, that room instead. Turn off the radiators in that room and you'll be saving a lot of gas, most likely, or electricity on that. It'll, in the long run, it'll pay for itself. It might take 20 years or something, but investigate it, because your mileage may vary. Different houses have different setups. This is something you're going to need to do independent research on. But also, this extract is from episode 19.
Yeah, so there are heat pumps that work without ducts. They're called, geniusly, ductless heat pumps, or mini splits. And I've actually got one in my office right here. It, if you've been to, like, on the continent in Europe, the hotels that have air conditioning units, they're usually a heat pump at one of these mini split ductless units. And the way that they work is that they don't require ducts. They just have these like little tubes or pipes that go right outside out of your walls. So in the UK, I don't know what the most viable one is, since I haven't looked into that market as much, but that would be an option for people that don't have ducts, don't want to do that duct work. And those are actually cheaper usually than doing an air source heat pump. So the average cost in the US on some of those is like $8,000 to $10,000 for doing a ductless system in your house.
If you hear the term geothermal heating being thrown around, that's basically just ground source heat pumps, because the ground, like a couple meters below the surface, is actually a lot hotter than it is at the surface. So we can use that temperature differential to make us, yeah, it's constant temperature year round. You can use that temperature differential to move heat from the ground to your house and heat your house up. So I need to go for dinner soon. So let's try and get through this last bit really quickly. But before we move on, if any of these solutions in terms of more efficient housing interest you, see the show notes below. There'll be some links. You can do a bit more research and potentially green up your own home. Also, if you see any petitions floating around about like Insulate Britain or, I don't know, like subsidized heat pumps, make sure to like sign them, and because we want the governments to be supporting these initiatives. But without further ado, planting trees on and around buildings supports local ecosystems, because you can have lots of animals living in the trees and it's all perfect. Increases air quality, because photosynthesis removes carbon dioxide, and I think trees might also help with particulate pollution. Not sure on that though. Reduces the impact of urban expansion on surrounding habitats, because if you keep the habitats there, just build a bit of urban around that, that's good for the animals. 4, lowers temperatures and provides shade. This is actually so important, because it means we can spend much less energy cooling our homes, and especially commercial areas and businesses.
Yeah, and also I'd like to add that, I mean, this sort of cloud of pollution around our cities actually causes a much greater heating effect in that general area. So if you don't have trees and there to create this sort of microclimate that's cooler and also helps clean the air and reduces particulate air pollution that might cause different breathing problems, then it can be very hot and just exacerbates the problem. Yeah.
Number 5, make cities nicer places to be. We all love trees. We all love being around trees. We all know that they make cities so much nicer to be in. And here's a little anecdote. In Australia, you see this sometimes in the UK, but not nearly as much. Like, in Australia, because the streets are a bit wider, you have verges, like grass verges, between the footpath and the road, whereas in England, it's almost always footpath, curb, road, with nothing in between. And often the council plants trees on these verges, and that makes it good. But here's a funny anecdote, is that when my grandma's house burnt down, it wasn't their like main house, it was their holiday house, and it got burnt down in a wildfire, because it's Australia, that's what happens. They wanted to basically just move their house on a truck to the burnt down house and replace it. But then they were told that they couldn't put it on the back of this truck, because the way that the trees were planted in their street, they were planted like parallel, which meant that the truck couldn't get through. Whereas usually they're planted like offset, so the truck can like weave between the trees. And that's why they just sold that land and took the insurance money.
So anyway, I just like to quickly go over some of the bigger ideas with sustainable architecture and some of the conceptual images that you might be seeing of sustainable architecture. I mean, this is what really interests me. I mean, I just think sustainable architecture, it's not only is it practical and sustainable, but it's just beautiful. I mean, if you see these conceptual buildings, so I mean, there's this sort of concept that's sort of widespread now to have these buildings. So Of course, if you've listened to previous episodes, you'll know that building up, despite controversy, is more sort of sustainable, more environmentally friendly than building out. Because when you build out, you're forced to encroach on more surrounding natural habitat than you are when you build up. And by building up, I mean building taller buildings. And when I say build out, I mean building cul-de-sac housing. And so when you build these larger buildings, one of these things that you'll see often sort of tied into sustainable architecture is having trees on balconies. And I just think it's such a beautiful thing. So there's a lot of these buildings where you'll have outcroppings, and these outcroppings provide space for mosses to grow. And then you'll have on the balconies, you'll have different shrubs and trees, and it's just like you're housing an entire ecosystem in your vertical building. And then there's this whole thing with sort of regreening, but regreening in sort of our flatter like buildings, so like malls, strip malls, which aren't great. But if you do have, I mean, there's some concepts for malls where you do have integrated waterfalls, methods for water retention, trees, and, you know, you manipulate an entire microclimate that can actually house birds, can house insects, and can house sometimes even some cervids or bovids, so like your deer and goats and different, or not goats, but like wild sheep or goats or whatever. And it's just this idea of integrating nature into our cities in a way that allows for animals to co-inhabit our suburbia with us. And I mean, I think that's just such a beautiful idea. What do you think, Os? And then just another thing, of course, with this idea of sustainable architecture is reusing materials. And so you were saying there's this whole problem with the overuse of cement, with the use of these plastic sort of slabs, and there's these sort of modern designs that entirely replace that with these recycled metals. And I know, of course, we're not supporting the overuse of metals like steel and iron, like you were saying earlier, but when implemented in a way that reuses old steel and iron and integrates it into your newer housing and newer buildings, it can be greatly sustainable. So also just, I mean, if you're looking into building a house, or if you are sort of an investor in a project for, you know, the installation of a new building or a new gym or whatever it is, it would be great to just look into the options out there for recycled materials. Because recycling, I think people, when they think of recycling, they think of recycling a plastic bottle, and that's 100%, you know, it's a great thing to do, recycling on the small scale. But there's also this, you can recycle on a large scale, and I think a lot of people miss this, is that metal is, it'll be around for a long time, it's reusable. Plastic, although we don't really support, you know, plastic buildings, it's 100% reusable. There's these different materials that are out there that you're taking down buildings, you can...
It's worth clarifying that plastic often can be only recycled a couple of times, whereas metals can be recycled infinitely, so it's a really important distinction to make.
But it's just, I mean, recycling on the large scale is a thing, and it's definitely something to look into. I was, I think, looking at a house in Vermont last summer. I think the house was, I mean, it was crazily, like, I loved the house. It was, had a completely modern design, 100%, like, it had these sustainable architecture sort of concepts installed. So I was just like, this is a wonderful house. It had this big garden. It had surrounding, not big garden, it was, you know, had a garden, surrounding forest, plenty of space to lay out sort of your vegetable garden. And then the house, I think, was recycled, some recycled metal. It looked like these old shipping containers, which are actually becoming increasingly popular in modern design. And it reused this metal in a way that just looked fantastic. And it built up this house, and it had geothermal heating. And it just goes to show that, like, you can integrate these sustainable architecture ideas into your home. 100% possible if you're building a new home. Like I said, I mean, it's definitely something to look into because it's 100% possible with our current resources and availability.
So just before we finish, I want to bring it back to steel and cement, these sort of two culprits of that are not just carbon intensive in terms of the energy that's used to produce them, but they're also carbon intensive in the literal chemical reactions that make them. And so unfortunately, there just isn't really any industrially like tested alternatives to these two methods or to the methods of producing steel and cement. And the only real solution at the moment is carbon capture. So if we just want to see what is the green premium, like how much extra do you have to pay to get these zero carbon or at least net zero carbon materials? So for ethylene plastics, the green premium is 9 to 15% extra. Steel, 16 to 29% extra. And for cement, it can cost up to 140% extra to get net zero carbon alternatives. So this is something that's going to need to be incentivized by governments through carbon taxes or other incentives if we want to have sustainable buildings, as well as integrating recycling. I'm not so convinced about shipping containers, though, because we generally do need more of those currently.
Yeah, the whole idea with the shipping containers is that there's some which are no longer in the best condition. Yeah, in the best condition to for practical use, so you can repurpose them in a sort of large-scale recycling process to build houses and other sort of buildings and installments. Yeah, anyway. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Fighting Failure.
If you enjoyed it, why not share it with someone who you think will find it valuable?
From Generation, this has been Fighting Failure. This will be the last installment of the Urban Expansion section. We'll be back soon with more Fighting Failure installments for you all in Season 3.
Our host and writer this week has been Hishan Kim. Copy editing and post-production by Oscar Archibald. Find all sources in the show notes.